This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Over the last several weeks, we've now been discussing the relationship between Kli and Teichen, between container and its content. And this evening we're going to take that discussion a little bit further, and we're going to look at some of these relationships in a more halachic environment, from a more halachic perspective, and to develop some ideas from those various halachas. There are kelim. Firstly, there are different types of kelim in halacha. There are different types of container that we're not going to deal with at this point. What does concern us is that there are containers made from different types of material. And the different types of material from which they are made determine to a large extent the halachas that apply to them. Basically, the kelim, as far as the deraisa, as far as the laws of the Torah itself are concerned, are kelim made from wood, clay eitz, clay matchus made from metals, clay oir, kelim made from leather, clay sack made from sack, from linen, clay beged from cloth, kelim made from cloth, clay eitz, I don't know if I mentioned wooden kelim, oir, leather kelim, and clay cheres, kelim made from earthenware. These various different kelim can be divided into two basic categories. On the one hand is clay cheres, those kelim that are made from earthenware. They have unique halachas, unique dinim. On the other hand, all the other kelim. There are certain differences between one and the other, but as far as the particular halachas that we're going to discuss this evening are concerned, we can categorize all the kelim, all the materials from which different kelim are manufactured, we can categorize them into clay cheres, earthenware utensils on the one hand, and all the rest on the other hand. That's the wood and the leather and the cloth and the sack and everything else, metal. What is unique about clay cheres? What is unique about kelim made from earthenware? The primary uniqueness is mentioned in our Sedra. Zeis hatoiro, these are the laws of Tumah. Adam ki yomus be'oihel, if a man should die in a building, kol ha-be'el ha-oihel v'chol asher be'oihel, anything coming into the building or anything that is in the building at the time of the death, yitmo shivas yomim, becomes tome, becomes impure for 7 days. V'chol kli posuach asher ein somid posil olov, and any vessel open that does not have a sealed lid upon it, tomehu. That kli also becomes tome. That utensil also becomes tome. We talked last week about a keli being the interface between the content and the outside world. And here we see some of the effects that the outside world has on the kli and vice versa. Rashi says on that, this kli which is being referred to in the posuk, b'klei cheres hakosav medaber. The Torah is talking here specifically about klei cheres, about earthenware utensils. She'ein mekabel tumo migaboy elo mitoche, which does not become tome from its outside, only from its inside. Let me briefly explain these halachas. Other kelim, kelim made from other materials, materials other than earthenware, become tome upon contact with something that is tome. So if they have contact with tumo, they become tome, but there must be contact. That contact can either be on the outside of the kli or the inside of the kli. And if the contact is the outside and the outside of the kli, then the tumo, this spiritual impurity, permeates the entire kli, and the whole kli, its inside as well, becomes tome, and it makes tome anything which is inside the kli, which is touching it inside the kli. That's all the other kelim. Klei cheres is very unique. Klei cheres, earthenware material, does not become tomei on contact. So in one sense, it appears to be more insulated against tumor. Klei cheres, earthenware utensils, tumor can be touching it on the outside, migabe, and nothing happens. It doesn't become tomei. However, in one area, klei cheres are much more severe. Because if tumor is inside the kli, but not touching the kli, suspended inside the kli, but there is no contact whatever, the kli still becomes tomei. Other kelim require, kelim made from other material require contact. That contact can be on the inside or the outside, but there must be contact. Klei cheres cannot become tomei by contact. Klei cheres becomes tomei by contents, by what it contains, even if its content is not touching it, even if it is insulated from the sides of the kli, from the sides of the container. Nevertheless, that tumor, that impurity of the content, affects the whole kli. And that's what Rashi means here when he says, She'ein mekabel tumor migabei elo mitoichri. Klei cheres do not acquire tumor from the outside, only from its inside. Lefichoch, and therefore, im ein megufas tzimidosoi, pesula olov, if its lid is not hermetically sealed upon it, bechibur, joined, tomehu, then the whole kli becomes tome, because the tumor is inside the kli. Hoim yesh tzomid posil olov, tohu. But if the kli, if this earthenware jar is hermetically sealed, then it can be found in the midst of the most severe tumor that there is. It can be right in the room together with the dead body. It can even be touching the dead body. The kli will not become tomei. So we see a very fascinating aspect of klei cheres, that they are able to insulate their contents from the tumor of the outside world. The only kli, only a klei cheres, only an earthenware utensil, is able to seal its content from the tumor of the outside world, provided it's fully sealed, fully closed, with earthenware. However, if its content is tome, if it contains tumor, even though there's no physical contact, then it becomes tome. Cheres, earthenware, is the most basic of all substances. Reishis boro, in the beginning, Hashem created heavens and Oretz. Oretz is earth. Earth is the basic fundamental component of this earth, which was first created, from which whatever else developed came, but that's what the world started with. Eretz, plain and simple land. The moment the Eretz, the moment land, Adomo, earth, becomes more sophisticated, whether it's through vegetation, or whether it's through animal existence, or whether it is through human manufacture, whether it's eitz, which is vegetation, whether it's oil, which is animal skin, whether it's mateches, whether it's metals, which is formed by a human being has to create metal from the earth. The moment it becomes more sophisticated than the pure earth itself, with its technical sophistication, with its technological sophistication, it loses some of its spiritual sophistication. The most spiritually sophisticated of materials is Adoma, earth. The more we become technologically sophisticated, the less spiritually sophisticated we become. And that's why as we become more and more technologically proficient, we become less civilized in many ways. And Odom, man is called Odom because he's made from Adom. So man is a neshama, he is a soul contained by a kli cheres, contained by a utensil designed by the Ribono Shel Olam from earth. So we have to view our bodies as having similar halachic properties, or at least philosophically as having properties similar to the halachic properties of the kli cheres, of the container made from earth. And what is the fundamental halacha that we've already established from this week's sedra? that the kli cheres, if it's sealed, can protect its contents from the tumor of its environment. And that's a wonderful thing to know, that the human being is capable of protecting his neshoma from the defilement of its environment if he keeps his neshoma hermetically sealed. As long as he makes sure that the kli cheres is intact, that it is closed at all times, he is in fact capable of maintaining the purity of his neshoma, no matter in what environment he finds himself. It's a risky thing to try, because even if one can find clothing that is radiation proof, none of us want to go walking around where there's a lot of radiation. Who wants to go and rely on the clothing? Better to keep away from it. So here too, one should try and keep away from a spiritually impure environment. But all environments on this earth already contain a degree of spiritual impurity. We can't get away from it. Since the chet of Adam HaRishon, since the sin of the first man, there is an element of impurity in everything. That doesn't mean that our neshomas have to be defiled too. Our neshoma is contained, our souls are contained in kelim of cheres. Our neshoma is contained in bodies made of earth. And just as a kli cheres is able to insulate its content from tumor, so the human being is able to insulate his soul from tumor. However, if the kli cheres contains tumor, then the kli becomes tome too. If the earthenware utensil contains something which is impure, then that impurity from the inside affects the outside. So what we see here is an interesting thing, that we are affected more by what's inside us than by what's outside us. Always you hear people emphasizing, be careful of the outside influences, and be careful of the outside influences, and don't do this, and don't do that. It's all true, it's all good, and we'll see further on exactly how the outside influences. But you very seldom hear people telling you, be careful of what's inside you. That's the problem area. A kli cheres can seal itself off from what's outside, but it cannot seal itself off from what's inside. And so instead of directing all our fears and all our concerns and all our guilts about what's around us, we need to turn inwards a little bit and check what's inside us. So you'll see people who will say, Chas v'shalom, they wouldn't go to such and such a place, they wouldn't go, tell me, wouldn't go there, wouldn't go to such a, good, it's very fine, wouldn't look at the television set, it's tome, good, very fine, wouldn't go here, wouldn't go there, fine, very good. But that's not enough. That, at least theoretically, it's possible to insulate yourself from. Practically, it's very difficult. But theoretically, it's possible to insulate from it. Does that same person worry just as much with what's inside him? What thoughts are inside him? What feelings are inside him? Are his thoughts of Kedusha? Are his thoughts of tumor? That's what's important. There's the lovely Gemara, I should have looked it up before the shiur to show it to you inside, with two Tanoim or Amirim, I don't remember, who had to choose a road to take. They had an option of walking down two roads. One road went past Avodah Zorah, and one road went through the red light district. And they had to take one of the roads. And they debated backwards and forwards which was the less dangerous road to take. And in the end they decided the red light district route was the less dangerous one to take. Because if they would be talking in Torah and thinking in Torah as they went through, that would protect them from it. What's the principle? What are they saying? We're going through an area which is outside. There's an environment which is thoroughly unhealthy around and about us. An environment which is full of defilement, an environment which is full of tumor. That we can, in theory, if we try very hard, we can seal ourselves off that, from that, provided the inside remains pure. And so if we go through that as quickly as we can without looking, and our thoughts all the time are busy in terror, we can maintain the integrity of our own purity even though we're in a foreign environment. It's far more important, if one can talk about more and less important in these matters, it's difficult because they're all important. But if one can talk about more and less important, what's really important is to control, to master, to watch what's inside rather than what's outside. It's true that very often what's inside is affected by what's outside. We'll come to that still. But what's important to know is that the only way the outside can affect you is by affecting your inside. So you have two chances to control your inside. The one chance is to be careful where you go. so that the outside doesn't get a chance to defile the inside. But you only go to places of Kedusha. That's very hard. There are not even that many shuls that you can go to today where you're sure you won't hear Lashon Hara. There are not that many yeshivas where you can go to that day where you can be sure you won't hear Dvarim Batalim, where you can be sure that you won't be encounter bad midas, where you can be sure that you won't hear anything dishonest. Where does one find such places? Very, very few, very seldom can you find an environment where you can feel totally relaxed, but here I'm in an environment which can do me no harm, and I can open up the seal. Very, very difficult. And so we almost have to settle with the unfortunate fact that until Mashiach comes, wherever we're going to go, we're going to find ourselves in an environment with more or less radiation, with more or less tumor around and about us. Our next barrier of defense is okay, so we can't control the outside. We can try to a certain degree, but we've got to go about our work. We've got to go to our offices, we've got to go to our shops, we've got to deal with our customers, we've got to carry on a normal life. We've got to drive in the streets, we've got to meet with friends. And it's not always on the standard and of the caliber that we would like it to be. But we can't practically seal ourselves away from the environment. But we have the opportunity of being within that environment and sealing our neshamas off from it, ensuring that what's inside us remains pure, remains tohu, that our thoughts are always pure, that our feelings are always pure, that our emotions are always pure. V'leisosuru acharei einechem, acharei levavchem, asher atem zoinim achareihem. Not to wander after your eyes. You see bad things, you hear bad things, that's bad enough, but you can stop it there. Doesn't go in. Seen it? Fine, that's terrible. But no further than that. That's not going to affect, that's not going to influence what's inside me. I am a kli cheres, and I have the ability to insulate my inside from the outside influences. And I must exercise that ability, and I must develop that ability, and I must strengthen that ability, and I must learn how to do it, because therein lies the key to my own spiritual survival. And so we need more thought about what's inside than about what's outside. People very often say, I'm not going to live in an area where there's Chilul Shabbos, I want to live in an area only where there's Shomer Shabbos. Fine. I'm not going to send my child to such and such a school, I want a school where everybody's an angel. Fine. All sorts of things you'll hear people saying, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this. All that is fine and very good, but it's not enough. That has to be taken much further. And there has to be an acknowledgement and an awareness that even though I might try to protect myself from a bad environment, I am always going to find myself in some way or another within a bad environment or within an environment which is partially bad. And therefore I have to have within myself the ability to seal myself off from that environment and to watch what's inside me. I've got to say, as I'm walking through an area which is perhaps not of the standard of Kedusha that I would like, or if I'm sitting among people who are not of the standard of Kedusha that I would like, I find myself at a simcha, or I find myself doing business with somebody that the standard of conversation is not really what I would like, that the value systems that I'm being exposed to is not really what I would like. My aggression, my watchful eye must be turned not towards them. Shegetz, you, Shegetz, ah, isn't it terrible that I have to even be seen with you? What can I do now? But, hey, the Baruch Shalom, may you forgive me for doing such a terrible thing. That's not where it is. You're there, there's nothing you can do about it. You've got to watch the Shegetz inside. What have you been thinking? What have you been plotting and scheming? Honest? Has your business plotting? Is your business scheming? As you've been sitting there with a Shegetz? Have you also been a Shegetz? Or have you been thinking straight? Have you been thinking honestly? Have you been thinking cleanly? You overhear a dirty joke, terrible thing, one shouldn't be in such an environment. But sometimes you can't help it, you're there and somebody says something that he shouldn't say. What's important is, did it get inside, or does the inside remain pure, does the inside remain clean? Somebody talks a little Lashon Hara, what do? To enjoy stir it up a little bit? Or are you closed off? Your mind, you're busy working out a difficult tosfos while he's talking his Lashon Hara, you don't even hear what he's saying. That is the capacity that the human being has to keep his inside pure, even when he's moving in circles which are impure, even when he finds himself unavoidably in an environment which lacks the purity that he would like. He must concentrate on, under those circumstances, on the Shegetz inside, not on the Shkotzim outside. The Shkotzim outside, the Kli Cheres, don't cause tumor. You can have as many shkotzim, you can take a klicheres and you can put it in a barrel of shkotzim. And if it's sealed, the klicheres remains tohe, remains pure. But one little shegetz, one tiny little shegetz, inside the klicheres. And you can put the klicheres in the middle of the Beis HaMikdash, doesn't matter. That klicheres becomes tohe. A klicheres has to watch its inside more than its outside. A human being has to watch its inside more than his outside. He's got to watch his outside in case there's a crack in the seal. But what he's really got to watch is that the inside is tohu. That none of that tumor is allowed to seep inside. And that his thoughts remain pure and his thoughts remain clean. Hard, isn't it? To control our thoughts. It's hard enough to control our deeds. To control our speech is murderously difficult. But we're not going to really get anywhere until we start undertaking the exercise of controlling our thoughts, of controlling our feelings. When we feel something, we've got to be able to stop ourselves and say, is that feeling a feeling of tahara or a feeling of tumah? Is it a legitimate feeling or is it an illegitimate feeling? And if it's an illegitimate feeling, to cast it out quickly, to make sure that it gains no access, and to allow only feelings and thoughts and words and concepts of kedusha into our minds and into our hearts. Very hard, but that's what a Jew is meant to be doing. Motivation, same concept. A human being can be motivated in two ways. The proverbial carrot and the stick. What's the difference? The stick is from outside. A human being can be bludgeoned and bullied into doing things. And depending on how strong the threats are and how weak the person is, it'll be a successful way of getting him to do things. But there's a far more successful way. Appealing to his inside. If one can communicate to his inside, that affects the outside already. We've discussed in previous shiurim how the kli, how the container affects the content. Now we're seeing that with a kli cheres, with a human being, the content affects the container more than the container affects the content. And it is the motivation, the way one feels, that determines the way one acts. If a person feels negative and down, he's going to act negatively and downwardly. And he's going to attract negativity. And he's going to attract failure. If a person feels positive and confident and on top of the world, he's going to attract success. It works that way. Because the inside affects the kli. The kli can become contaminated by the feelings. The kli can become contaminated by the ideas and the concepts. The kli, the human being with all his personality, is dominated totally and motivated by what's inside him. And that's why it is so important to watch what's inside. And all these motivational courses that they use with sportsmen and with record breakers and with salesmen and all these things, where they psych them up, as they say. What does it mean, psyching them up? Just getting the insides sufficiently full of energy and the right attitudes. They talk about having the right attitudes. That's what it means. When the right attitudes are inside, the kli is affected and it shines and it sparkles. And when the attitudes inside are negative and dull and pessimistic, the kli, the object, the container becomes dull and becomes negative and becomes unattractive. But it works the other way too. A kli which is tome. Let us now imagine a kli cheres, an earthenware vessel, which is tome. And we put into it a piece of food which is not tome. Put into it food which is tohu. What happens to the food? It becomes tome too. So just as a kli cheres is influenced and can be defiled by that which is inside it, so the kli cheres influences and can defile that which is inside it. Works both ways. You can start off with a good content and the container can destroy the content. And that one has to watch, because you can have a personality who has become so negative, who has become so destructive, that even if you feed positive things into him, they become negative within him. He turns them into things negative. There can be such a thing as a kli cheres, which is tome. It's been spoiled already. It's damaged. It's tome.
And now whatever you put into it, it becomes tumah.
We had a fascinating example of that in a Chazal, in a lady's shiur recently, where in the 20th perek of Iyov, Sefer HaNa'amosi explains to Iyov that although it sometimes looks as if the Rishoyim, as if the wicked people have got it good, if you watch a little bit more carefully and you really analyze their situations, you find it's not quite as good as you think. And he gives an image of the wicked person who tends to be able to eat all sorts of damaging food and not be damaged by it. And I gave the ladies the example, which they found particularly pleasing, of those wicked people who can eat sweets and chocolates and not get fat, when all the righteous people eat sweets and chocolates and they do get fat. And Sefer HaNa'amosi gives that as the image. And you look at it and you say, my goodness, isn't that so unfair? I just have to touch one little chocolate and I put myself on the scale the next morning and I'm 5 kilos up. And look at them, they eat whatever they want and they stay as thin as a stick. One person smokes 20, 50, 100 cigarettes a day and is well into his 90s and is as fit as a fiddle. And another person, Nebuch, is sick, he's ill, and the doctor says, because you've been smoking. He says, but what do you mean, 10 cigarettes a day, that's all I had? He said, that's enough, that's what caused it. But look at him, 100 cigarettes a day and he's fit as a fiddle. It irritates one. So we look at a Rosho and we see things are going well. So far, HaNa'amosi, you've got to wait till the end. Because at the end what happens is that those people, even when they eat good food, they find that it causes them harm. That's what happens. The person who can eat the chocolates and not put on a pound, wonderful. But there comes a time in his life where even when he eats healthy food, it has a negative effect. Lachmoy b'me'ov ne'epach. His bread, healthy bread, in his intestines become converted into meroiras pesonim b'kirboi, to the point where he has the gall of serpents in his stomach. Healthy things become unhealthy. Tasty things become untasty, ultimately. So don't think it's so wonderful. The Rosh has got it so wonderful. You've got to wait. You've got to see how it all ends up at the end. At the end it comes out that even good things he can't really stomach. He can't really tolerate. Chayu bolo. He swallows healthy food. Vayeki enu. And he vomits it out. Mibitnoi yorishenuke. It's Hashem who's chasing it out, who's expelling it from his stomach. Not because it's unhealthy. It's healthy, but the Ribbono Shel Olam is expelling it as an onesh, as a punishment. This gets expelled from his stomach. That's what the Sefer HaNa'amosi says. David HaMelech used this posuk in the discussion with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin Kuvov, Omar Rebbe said, Omar David lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. David HaMelech said before the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam, Yomus Doeg, let Doeg die. David HaMelech prayed for the death of Doeg. Doeg was a very colorful and wicked character in the life of David HaMelech. Doeg was a very great Rav, a very big Talmid Chochem, a master of Jewish law and Jewish knowledge. But he was wicked. And you might think that those two things don't go hand in hand, but I've got news for you, very often they do. There is nothing to say that a person, because he has mastered the knowledge of Torah, that he's necessarily a tzaddik. A wicked person can also master the knowledge of Torah. And Doeg was one of the greatest Talmidei Chachomim of the time. And he was responsible for deaths, and he made David HaMelech's life a misery. And David prays for his death. And the Mefoshim explained that's not because David was mean or jealous or whatever, but David felt that there would be Chilul Hashem. That people wouldn't know. Doeg is the big Rav, Doeg is the Dayan, the Rosh HaSanhedrin, Doeg is the big Talmid Chochem. Nothing that he can do can be wrong. And he's setting a bad example. People are going to begin to think, that's Torah. And what can I answer them, says David? If I say to them he's not really a Talmid Chochem, they laugh at me. So I've got to acknowledge that he's a Talmid Chochem. If he's a Talmid Chochem and that's how he behaves, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? How am I going to explain and justify his wicked, wicked, destructive behavior to people who think it must be right because he's so great?
Therefore, there is no option but he must die. This is too destructive to the name of Hashem.
So the Rebbeinu Shem answers him with this pasuk. Don't worry, David.
Chayu bolo vayekien. All that Torah which he has swallowed, all that wisdom, will eventually be vomited out. Don't worry. People will eventually see that it's nothing. Be patient. Don't be so impetuous. Be patient.
Amar l'fono, so David answers with the second part of the pasuk.
Mibitna yorishenu kel, but the pasuk says that Hashem makes him vomit. Let's see already. Let's get it out from him.
Be that as it may, it's clear then that the Gemara learns this image of Tzofar when he says, Lachmoi b'me'ov ne'epoch.
His bread is converted in his intestines into the gall of a serpent.
How's the Gemara learning that?
What bread?
The bread that he ate at the table? No, that's not the meaning of the image. In lechem el ha-toyro.
The Torah which is in his, the Torah which he has consumed in his inside will become converted to the gall of a serpent. It will become negative and destructive. He will use it destructively. It will become bitter and distorted.
You'll say, how can that be? Somebody said to me today, it can't do any harm to learn Torah. Ooh, and how it can. And how it can. Learn Torah the wrong way. Learn Torah with the wrong guidance and see the arrogance oozing out. See the arrogance, the self-satisfaction, the feeling of superiority, the making of other people feel small, the loss of certain value systems even. As I said to you, I think a few weeks ago, one of my colleagues complaining that it's a terrible thing that in many cases, as people become frum, as young people become frum, so they become, and he used the phrase, chayos rois, bad animals. They lose their menschlichkeit, and people are beginning to ask. Parents are saying, my child was a mensch. Now he's become frum and he's become totally inconsiderate. Totally inconsiderate and bombastic and superior and arrogant. Not so simple that learning Torah can do no harm. That's no excuse not to learn Torah. One has to learn Torah. But one has to learn it the right way. One has to learn it together with Musa. One has to learn it together with ethics. One has to learn it together with character development. One has to take, you can take the antibiotics, but you've got to take vitamins with it too. Learn Torah, but the musar has to come with it too. It has to be guided, it has to be gentle, it has to be integrated. Here we've got a case of Derek Haedemi, that wicked Talmid Chochem, about who we say, Lachmoy b'meyov ne'epoch, you can put the finest of Torah into that stomach of his, but the kli is tomeh. And when you put something tohur into a kli which is tomeh, when you put a pure substance into an impure utensil made of earthenware, which we are, it makes the contents tomei too. And that food, that bread, that Torah is converted in his inside to meruiras pesonim, to the gall of a serpent. That's the effect we can have on our contents. So our contents can cause us to become impure. That which we contain can cause us to become impure. But also our impurity can contaminate that which is inside us. And so it's a two-way system. Back again to the old concept. The inside affects the outside affects the inside. Male affects female, female affects male. There's a two-way relationship, and it has to be watched all the time. How does one determine what is inside one? How does one know what's inside one? How does one know what's inside an individual? Is there purity or is there impurity inside him? Doeg ha'edomi, one can imagine him. A rov, a dayan, a rosh yeshiva, with a very long beard, a very big hat, and a very long coat. And it must have been very difficult to be able to relate to the fact that Doeg ha'edomi was one of the biggest rishoyim of that period and of all times. Very hard to relate to that. Very difficult. How does one know? I explained a lovely concept in a medrash very briefly at the wedding on Tuesday night. And I want to use that concept to give us some kind of insight into what it is to relate to the inside of the person. The Sedra opens with the law of the Pora Aduma, the red heifer.
a law which the Torah tells us is a chok, chukah. That's a statute. The word chok literally means an engraving. And Chazal tell us that this is one of the halachas about which the Yetzer Hara tries to undermine. This is a law which intellectually we endeavor to undermine. And the Torah warns us, Chuko chukakti, gezeiro gezarti, I have engraved the statute, I have decreed this law, ve'in locho rushus laharer achareho, and you have no right to undermine it. Why is this law particularly susceptible to intellectual undermining? Question one. Question two, what is the answer? I've engraved the statute, I've decreed the law, you don't have permission to undermine. You don't have permission to undermine anything. What is the engraving, what is the image of engraving got to do with the incorrectness of any form of intellectual undermining of this particular law? This is not the only law which the Yetzer Hara endeavors to undermine. Rabbi Yeshua de Sachnin b'shem Rabbi Levi Omar, the Medrash tells us in the Sedra that Rabbi Yeshua de Sachnin, in the name of Rabbi Levi, said, Arbo dvorim Yetzer Hara meshiv aleihem. Dichtiv bohen chuko. There are four halachas which the Yetzer Hara endeavors to undermine. About all four, the term chuko is used. Which are the four? Number one, Eishes Ach. The law of the wife of one's brother. So a man is not permitted to marry his brother's wife even after the death of his brother. It's a serious issue in the laws of Arayis, not permitted. However, if his brother dies without children, it's a mitzvah to marry the brother's wife. We don't perform that mitzvah today, but that's the reason why we need chalitza in such a situation. And the normal circumstances, it becomes a very great mitzvah to marry the very woman whom one is totally prohibited to in all other circumstances. That's one case. Second one is kilayim. We're not permitted to wear garments of linen and wool. However, if it's a linen garment with woolen tzitzis, it's a very great mitzvah. Second case. Third case, se'ir hamishtaleach. The two goats that we use on Yom Kippur. We send off, you remember, the one gets shechted and the one goes to the cliff. The person who prepares the goats becomes tome. He becomes impure. And yet the goats are the source of kapora, the source of atonement. So what are these goats? Are they good or bad? Do they have positive effect or negative effect? On the one hand, they bring about atonement, and on the other hand, they cause tumor. Very peculiar. And the fourth one is pora aduma. Pora aduma has the capacity more than any other substance, the ashes of the pora aduma more than any other substance can cleanse a person who's become impure. And yet the people who manufacture that ash from the pora aduma become impure themselves. These are the four cases of chukim where there's an attempt by the intellect to undermine them. Why? What's the attempt to undermine these laws specifically? Because it's very difficult to figure them out. Let a man look at his relationship with his sister-in-law. Is that a relationship that should be encouraged or discouraged? Very difficult to say. If his brother is alive, discouraged, of course. If his brother died and had children, discouraged. But if his brother died without children, oh, it's a big mitzvah to make such a shidduch. But what is it then? Is it kosher or is it treif? The next case, kilayim. Linen and wool together. Is that kosher or treif? It's treif. And a tzitzis, a garment of linen with tzitzis of wool, big mitzvah. How come? Is it right or is it wrong? And the Yetzer Hara loves to ask that kind of question. I'm sure you've heard it often. The term, is it either kosher or treif? Tell me what it is, kosher or treif? To intellectually handle these ambiguous situations requires a great deal of intellectual maturity. And people don't like handling it. They like handling clear cut, black or white, kosher or treif. And we can't figure it out with these things. We analyze the object, you don't know. The two goats. Are they a source of kedusha or a source of tumah? Do they breed sanctity or impurity? If they breed sanctity, why does the person who attends to them become tameh? If they breed impurity, how can they atone for Yisrael? And the same question with the pora aduma. It cleanses on the one hand and it defiles on the other. What is this pora aduma? Is it tameh or is it tohu? What are these ashes?
And what the chukah means is that if you analyze the objects here, analyze the ash of the Porah Aduma, analyze a garment of linen and wool, analyze the relationship of brother-in-law and sister-in-law, you can analyze until you're blue in the face. You won't find out whether it's right or wrong, whether it's kosher or treif. It's chukko chokakti. What's chukko chokakti? And I explained that there are two ways of writing, of conveying information by means of writing. The one way is through the superimposition of one substance upon another. You write with a pen on a blank piece of paper, and you're superimposing ink over the paper, and you can read the writing. Or you do it by some form of embossing. Put one substance on top of the other substance. But there's another way of altogether, and that's through engraving, using only one substance. Most cases of writing, we need two different substances. In the case of engraving, you can do it with only one substance. You can engrave into the substance itself. And these two forms of written communication are symbolized in the Tfilin Shel Rosh, where on the one side of the Tfilin Shel Rosh we've got a three-pronged shin, and on the other side we've got a four-pronged shin. Some people have never noticed that, and when they do notice, they get a shock and come and ask if the Tfilin are kosher. That's how it's supposed to be. Three prongs on the one side and four prongs on the other side. Why? What's a four-pronged shin? Who's ever heard of a four-pronged shin? A four-pronged shin is an engraved shin. And if you look at the engraving, it's only three prongs. It's four outside prongs, but in between there are three inside. So you've got a shin on the one side of the Shel Rosh, which is a superimposition. Therefore, you've got three reliefs, three-pronged relief. And on the other side, you've got a four-pronged relief, because what you're meant to look at is the space in between the relief. And there are only three. That's the engraved shin. Two ways of communicating information. What's the difference between them? The difference is as follows. If you took a piece of paper with writing on it, with ink writing on it, or you took a canvas with painting on it, to a scientist, and you said, I want to blindfold you so that you can't see the material you're dealing with, and you've got to analyze it, put it into your machinery and break it down into its fundamental components, and then I'll let you, once it's all destroyed, we'll unblindfold you, and you need to tell me, was there writing on this canvas, was there writing on this paper or not? He could do it. He could analyze the substances, and he'll find paper, and he'll find ink. He'll find canvas, and he'll find paint. And he will come to the not too difficult conclusion that there was writing, or there was an image on this canvas or on this paper. It was an image of ink, or it was an image of paint. But if you take a tablet on which something has been engraved, and you melt it down, or you crush it up, and you give it to the scientist and say, was there anything written on this? Take the Luchos Habris, take the tablets of stone that Moshe brought down from Sinai, and chop it up, destroy it, as Moshe in fact did the first time, and then give it to a scientist in powder form, and say, can you, with any analysis on this earth, tell me whether there was any writing on this? And he'll analyze and analyze, and he'll say, there was no writing on this. This is pure marble. There's nothing else here. He could be making a grave error, because even on pure marble there could be writing if it's engraved. That is a chok. A chok is a situation where you can analyze the object for as long as you want, and you won't find the message, you won't find the concept. A chok is something where you need to be able to see the engraving. What is the engraving? The way the luchos were engraved, it wasn't just indentations, it was right through. Engraving is the creation of content through empty spaces. A most wonderful concept. Think of what engraving is. Taking a tablet of stone, which is an empty block of nothing, not nothing, stone, meaningless, and through a process of engraving, turning that into the Aseres Hadibros, into the two tablets of stone with all its attendant Kedusha. What is it that gives those tablets of stone that Kedusha? The empty spaces between the stones. Those are the letters. That's the information. That's where you find the content. So sometimes content is superficial, and it's superimposed on the outer surfaces of the substance, and sometimes it's engraved into the substance itself. And then you have to read the message not by analyzing the substance, but by reading the empty spaces between the substances. That's where you'll be able to read it. A chok is a situation you can analyze your linen and your wool. You can analyze the brother and sister-in-law relationship. You can analyze and analyze. You can call in the psychologists and the philosophers and whoever you want, even the sexologists as they now have them, and they will not be able to tell you whether it's a healthy relationship or it isn't, because that's not the issue.
They're looking at the substance, they're looking at the stone. But there's a halachic superimposition on it. And in the case of a chok, that superimposition is no discernible substance. It's created by the engraving into it. You have to analyze the situation. You have to see the halachic dimension in order to know whether in that particular circumstance, this particular object, the ashes of the cow, the red heifer, or the two goats that we use on Yom Kippur, you have to analyze the halachic dimension to know whether inherently they are powers of Kedusha or powers of Tumah. Be that as it may, this conveys a lovely image of the perception of content by watching the empty spaces. That's where you see the real content, by watching the empty spaces. There are human beings who do a lot of good, and yet they can be Rishoy, because they do a lot of harm as well. The measure of a person's content is not by what he does, it's by what he doesn't do. It's not by what he says, it's by what he doesn't say. To analyze the stone, to analyze the tablet, that's easy. But that's not going to tell you about the content. When you're dealing with chukas ha-toiro, when you're talking about concepts of Torah, of Kedusha, of Tumah and Taro, these are chukim. And when you're looking at the spiritual sanctity of a person's inside, you can judge it by the empty spaces, not by what's there. I've often mentioned to you that one has to know how to read a letter of a Godel. One has to know how to read a smicha document. I've been shown smicha documents proudly by the owners of them, and frankly, if they understood those smicha documents, they would be too embarrassed to show them to anybody. They would just tell people they've got smicha. They wouldn't show them. And you'll say, why? What's wrong? And he takes it out and he reads it to you, and it says, this is to certify that Harav, Hagun, Haniflu, Haadir, oof, most wonderful genius, etc., etc., has been examined by me, and I found in this, that, and the other wonderful document. But you've got to notice what's missing. You've got to know what a standard document looks like and be able to compare and say, look, I'm not interested in what he says. What he says, there can be all sorts of reasons for. He wants to make you feel good. He wants to encourage you. He was put under pressure. There can be all sorts of reasons why he had to write a flowery document. But where he is master of his pen is in what he chooses to omit. And that's where you really see the content of the document. What has he omitted? What could he have said that he hasn't said? What should he have said that he hasn't said? The haskomas of Sforim, sometimes you'll open a sefer and in the beginning there are haskomas, there are documents of recommendation which various gedolim have given. They're fascinating to read. Of course, the documents of the gedolim in the earlier days were masters of careful wording. They're all masters of careful wording. But very often today, you will find that gedolim give haskomas more readily. And in asking just before Reb Moshe Feinstein's death, why he had a principle of giving a haskoma, he would give a recommendation to whoever asked him for it. There was only one sefer that he didn't give a recommendation to. One sefer that he held was deceitful from beginning to end, and that he wouldn't recommend. But all the other, anybody else has ever asked him is given for. And I was told the answer was that he said, anybody who's going to use the sefer because of my recommendation deserves to waste his time with it. A person who's got any sense will make his own decisions. But meanwhile, at least because of my recommendation, this poor man will be able to sell a few more sforim and he'll be able to make a little bit of money. So what's the problem? But how careful he was in the wording. Flowery? But you've got to note what's left out. And when you see what's left out and you read the haskoma carefully, you realize and you can discriminate between one haskoma and another. The real content has to be reading the spaces, the empty spaces. That's where you determine content. When the goy came to Hillel and he said, I want to be taught the Torah on one foot, Hillel did not say, Ve'ahavto l'reacha kamoicha, do to others as you would have them do to yourself, because even a Rosho can do that. It's possible Hitler loved children, little children, very kind to children and to animals. One can do all sorts of wonderful acts of heroism, even if one is a Rosha. What Hillel answers him is, Madasani loch, machaver cholitzavid. Don't do to others what you don't like done to yourself. For that you have to be a tzaddik. To restrain yourself. To hold yourself back. That's where you can see what's inside a person. The more there is inside a person, the more restrained he can be. the more impetuous he is, and the quicker he is to act in stupid ways very often, and to say things which are foolish, the less there is inside. A person can restrain himself if he feels self-satisfied. If a person feels inadequate, he's got to pull other people down, otherwise he won't feel adequate. If a person feels adequate, he doesn't have to pull other people down. He doesn't have the same taiva to talk Lashon Hara. It's not that important to him if he feels full. The English saying that empty barrels make the most noise is taken from the Gemara. That's something that's taken right out from the Gemara. Where there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of emptiness. The fuller the person is, the more solid the inside, the less noise there is, not the more. Read the spaces. Read the silence. Read the restraint. And then you'll understand what there is in a person. A person who doesn't utter a particular word because he thinks it can be damaging, he thinks it could be negative. The person who doesn't knock another individual or another institution because he feels it's not right, it could be damaging, irrespective of what gains he himself could acquire from it. That's where one establishes content. Content is read through the empty spaces in between. Watch the things people don't do, and then you'll know what's inside them. Watch the things we don't do, and then we'll know what's inside us. The more we are able to restrain ourselves, the more depth we have, the more kedusha we have, the more tahara we have. There's another interesting halacha that we'll briefly look at with regard to the kli cheres. And that is that the other kelim, metal kelim and so on, when they become tome, can all achieve tahara, can all be purified in the mikveh. A kli cheres can't. If a kli cheres has become tome, it cannot be purified in the mikveh. The only way it can be purified is when it is smashed, when it is broken. Then it becomes tohu once again. But as long as it retains its original form, it doesn't become tohu. That concept applies not only in Tumah and Taro, but in the laws of Kashrus as well. You can kasher a metal object with heat and with water, one can kasher it. But one cannot kasher an earthenware kli. The Gemara in Psochim says that kli cheres en yoytze midoifyo lo'ilam. The effect of the treif can never be taken out of the walls of a kli cheres, of an earthenware utensil. And the Tosfos asks right there in Daf Lamed in Psochim, but we know that there is a way of getting it out. One can kasher even a kli cheres by putting it back into the furnace. And Rabbi Natam answers, that's not called kashering the kli cheres. That's called making it into a new one. Because that's the way you make a kli cheres, it has to be put into the furnace. So by taking it back into the furnace, you are renewing it, it's becoming a new kli. But in principle, the old kli can never be kashered. And once it becomes tomei, it can never be made tohir again. It has to be broken or reformed in order for it to become tome, or in order for it to become kosher. And if we are kli cheres, that sounds a little bit ominous. That means that if chas v'sholim something happens to us, and we do become defiled, our hermetic seal is a little bit damaged at a time that we find ourselves in an unclean environment, what then? And we chas v'sholim have a moment of unclean thought, and we find in our contents that there's something which is treif, which is not meant to be there. People are very worried about what they eat, and they're right to be worried about what they eat. Why are they so worried about what they eat? Why is kashrus such an obsession among frum Jews? Because you're taking it inside yourself. It's becoming part of you. You're consuming it. It's going inside the kli. That's fine. You have to be very careful with kashrus. But food is not the only thing that we take inside us. We take thoughts and ideas inside us. We take ambitions inside us, we take feelings and emotions inside us, all those have to be just as kosher and just as mahadrin. And if something happens at chas v'sholem, we've got a treif thought inside us, an unclean thought, that could make us tomeh. And if we are tomeim, if we ourselves, if our personalities become defiled, we saw in that piece of Eiv with the Gemara and Sanhedrin what effect that can have. That means that even the Torah we start learning becomes negative and becomes distorted and becomes distracted. We can never come right. And if we're kli cheres, then there is no solution. What a terrible thing. But the Ribbono shel Olam allowed for a solution.
There's a piece of Ikrim which I have done with you once again, and I'm going to quote only a small part of it, and those of you who were here at the time will remember it, where the Ikrim discusses how it is that through davening we can change a gezeirah. Hashem has decreed something against us. How can our prayers have it changed? If God has decreed that so-and-so is going to die, how can prayer change that decree? That's the question that the Ikrim deals with. And he develops an idea through a whole process in the fourth maimer in Perek Yudches. Shehagzeiros ha'elokius hein heino bihiyos ha'mekabel b'hachonu madrega yudua. The decrees of Hashem apply to the mekabel, the kli, the utensil. He is going to receive them. When he subscribes to a particular defined form, when he is a particular being, but if the individual changes his level, thus changing his essence, then the gezeira no longer applies to him. He's a new being. And that's why when somebody is very ill, we change their name. The idea of changing their name is not just some kind of hocus pocus, but it's dwelling on this principle of the gezeira applied to an old person, but if we can renew ourselves, then it is possible to change the gezeira, then the gezeira no longer applies to us. That's how tshuva works, says the Ikrim. How can tshuva work? How can you fix something which has gone wrong? Just as if A murders B, how does it do tshuva? You can't bring B back into life. So with any avera, you can't reverse the effect of what you've done. Person was mechalel Shabbos. How is he going to do tshuva? Is he going to unmechalel the Shabbos? What's he going to do? No, it says the principle is that by tshuva shal yudea to tshuva, by repentance, he hu keilu nehepach leish acher shalei nigzera alav oisa gzeiro. He is as if he is changing himself to a new being. So indeed we are klei cheres, says the Ikrim. And we cannot be cleansed. Once we've gone off and we've gone wrong, there's nothing to do except back into the furnace. Make ourselves new. Change. Through Shinui Hashem is the concept. Changing the name is the idea. Tshuva is actually working on ourselves to change ourselves into new beings. The Ribbono Shel Olam has given us the ability, the remarkable gift of His Chadshus, to actually change ourselves, to renew ourselves into people that we weren't before, so that whatever ill effect we had before no longer applies. The last time I learnt with this with you, we took it pshuto kimashmo, we took it just like that. That I could have done something wrong, chas v'sholem, and there's a gezeira upon me. By changing myself, I escape the gezeira because I'm not the same person anymore. But that's a bit of trickery really, isn't it? Okay, so every time you do something wrong, change yourself and you've escaped again. That's really, you're tricking the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now we have a deeper insight into that. It's not that just that I'm escaping the avera. But through the process of tshuva, I break myself down and reconstitute myself. And that means that I'm a better person. That means I've undone the ill effect of the tumor, that bad effect of that defilement, so to say, has been undone, and I've been able to recreate myself into a new, cleansed, clean, clean, which no longer is metame, which no longer causes that which is inside me to become tome. And so we have to use all these principles hand in hand. On the one hand, we have to be careful in what environments we find ourselves. For we shouldn't rely at the first point on our hermetically sealed clay cheres, on our earthenware utensils capable of protecting our inside from the outside. But since, unfortunately, at all times we inevitably find ourselves in atmospheres and environments which are not 100%, very difficult ever to find oneself in an environment which is 100%, what can we do? We still have the capacity to seal ourselves. We seal ourselves by ensuring that our inside thought and feeling processes are not being affected by the outside. That we are not reacting to the outside, but we are mastering and dominating the outside. That we are taking control of it. You remember the lovely Chazal when the Chachomim, Rabbi Akiva and Gamliel, I think it was, were walking near the Har HaBayis, and they came round the corner and a very beautiful woman walked right in front of them. Didn't see her. Had they seen that she was there, they would have taken another route, but they came round the corner and there she was. What did they do? They didn't, at that stage it was too late to avoid it.
They didn't deny her presence. That wouldn't have helped either. All they made sure was that their inner thoughts were pure. And one of them praised the Ribbono Shel Olam for creating such beauty. And you remember Rabbi Akiva, who spat and cried at this and laughed at the same time. He spat to think that something so beautiful is going to decay eventually. It's really nothing. He cried because this beauty was eventually going to decay. He spat because what does it really come from? What is a human being? A bit of DNA after all. What is it? It's nothing. And he laughed with pleasure because he knew with Ruach HaKodesh that he was destined to marry this woman eventually. And he was able at the same time to make sure that that effect, that event was not a negative event. It happened. It shouldn't have happened, but it did happen. There you are. You find yourself there. What do you do? Watch the inside. Don't shout to the outside. Watch the inside. I mentioned once the lovely occasion, I'll never forget, it's like it's engraved in my mind. Late one Friday night, very, very late, I was walking just outside the Meir Shorim area in Yerushalayim. And there was a little yid walking in front of me, a few paces in front of me, and a car passed. And this little yid said softly, I could just hear it, Shabbos, Shabbos. And I couldn't restrain myself, and I went up to him and I said, Rabbi Yid, if you were shouting at the car, he didn't hear you. And if you knew he wasn't going to hear you, why shout? Why have aggravation? And he looked at me and he said, young man, I wasn't shouting at the car. I was just making sure how it affects me. I've got to remember it's Shabbos. He's forgotten the Shabbos, that's his business. But I mustn't forget that it's Shabbos. Worrying about the inside. Didn't throw stones at the car. That's not the solution. Throw out all your aggravation and all your frustration on your environment and bring out all this wrath and aggression and anger against your wicked environment, this tumor around you. No. Watch the inside. Rabbi Tukhachinsky told me the other day, beautiful, this is the Gemara says, why is the parsha of Nozir immediately after the parsha of Soita? Nozir is a man sanctifies himself by ceasing to have contact with alcoholic drinks. And that's told to us immediately after the parsha of a woman who's been unfaithful. And Chazal say, because kol haroyeh soito bekilkulo, if a person has seen a woman being unfaithful, what must he say? What must he say to himself? Oi, terrible, shaggy, cheater, what are you doing? Pour your wrath onto your environment? No, says the Gemara. Yozir atzmoi min hayayim. You become a nozir. Just watch what effect it has on you. Don't change. You can't change the environment so easy. That's not such a simple thing to do. First thing, protect your inside. And make sure that you retain your sanctity. Become a nozir. Withdraw from the world a little bit. That's the solution. The answer when we find ourselves in negative situations is not to become aggressive against the situation. And not to project all our anger and our self-disappointments onto our environment. But the first thing is to watch that we remain pure inside. The second thing at the same time we have to, while we're watching our inner purity, we've got to make sure that if chas v'sholem we have experienced impurity, something has seeped inside, that we do tshuva. That we go through a process of reconstruction, of rebuilding ourselves constantly, all the time. This isn't something only for a Shoshana and Yom Kippur. Constantly, all the time, we go into a process of continual renewal. That's part of the meaning of Rosh Chodesh, every month to remind us. We are capable of renewing ourselves every month, every day, at every moment. Of taking ourselves to pieces and putting ourselves together again. So that we become new Kalim. Because if Chas V'Sholom we don't, then not only do we remain defiled, but everything inside us becomes defiled, and everything we learn becomes distorted and becomes negative. All our thoughts become negative, all our feelings become negative. We are masters of that which is inside us. We can control that which is inside us. We can purify ourselves and that which is inside us. We can make sure that that which is inside us is only thoughts of beauty, thoughts of sanctity, thoughts of straightness, thoughts of kedusha, thoughts of correctness, and thereby we will ensure that the kelim, the utensils, the containers which we are, remain in their purity, thus interacting backwards and forwards, improving the purity of our content, the content impuring the purity of the container, helping us step by step to raise ourselves and to improve ourselves in our pursuit of kedusha.